Hey, what's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Over the Cap podcast for June 4th, 2021. This is Jason Fitzgerald, and you can find me on Twitter at Jason_OTC, or of course at overthecap.com. We've got Nelly. Nelly, say hi. Nothing yet. So Nelly the Bunny, still hanging out once again for the podcast. Usually a pretty silent partner, so we'll see how much noise she decides to make during the course of this one here. No beer of the week. No beer tonight. Just decided not to do the beer tonight since we're pretty much just doing light beers anyway. So that's almost like drinking nothing anyway. So we'll be back with a beer of the week maybe next week or the week thereafter. But we'll be back with something. So hopefully you guys are having something a little bit better. Some type of craft beer or something that you enjoy while giving a listen to the podcast. And, you know, not a lot of stuff this week. Slow week, you know, June 1st kind of came and went. A lot of people thought that it was going to lead to a flurry of trades. I'm not really sure why people would have thought that. You know, you can agree to trades long before. I mean, look at the trades that happened at the start of the new league year, right? Carson Wentz's fate was decided long before the start of the league year. Nick Foles the prior year was agreed upon and reported upon way before the start of the next league year. Jared Goff and Matt Stafford this past year. So if a trade for Julio Jones would have been on the table, would have been agreed to, it would have leaked out. So I don't know why anyone thought like it was magically going to happen on June 2nd. But anyway, we have everything processed and we'll keep up with the trade rumors as they go on throughout the summer and then through the year. And, you know, right now we're in a really slow portion of time for the NFL. So we'll just go over a couple things and mainly just going to do your questions here. One of the things that I did want to mention really before getting into anything, if you get a chance to listen to Kevin Cole's Unexpected Points podcast for this week. I've appeared on there as a guest before, but he has a really good one this week about ranking kind of the front offices. And I almost thought I was going to piggyback on that this week and kind of steal the idea just to share a couple of different thoughts with some of the teams that he mentioned there. I'm not sure about going through everybody. But I thought it was really good. And so I don't know, maybe at some point we'll piggyback on that. Cause I do like to talk about how I think some of the teams stack up. I would look at it a little differently, than he did. You know, he was looking at it more from, and he was taking contracts into view here too, but here you're looking at like the, how much they've adopted into analytics and, some things that they've done. I probably look at it just a little bit more in terms of just pure team building versus investments that the teams are making. There's definitely certain teams that stand out in terms of investments that they're making. You know, one of them that he mentioned clearly on there was the Browns, and that's definitely the case. You know, they come from the Eagles system, and the Eagles are a team that does that. They invest a lot. But, you know, a lot of times, I think right now what you see happening is a lot of teams investing doesn't necessarily mean they're utilizing. You know, there's a difference between the two. You know, you look at Jacksonville, who's one of their big hires is already gone because clearly there was a conflict that was going on there and the coach is going to run the system. I'm not saying that that's right or wrong, but just that I think that that happens a lot of times. You know, you get to something where it's like, well, everybody's doing it, so you do it, but it doesn't necessarily mean you utilize it. So it's, I think it's a little difficult to tell what they're doing because, you know, having a name, having a hire, having a couple of people, sometimes doesn't mean that much in the grand scheme of things if it's not going to be utilized. It is surprising to me, you know, just on that front, though, that more people are not being hired by the league in these areas. And not just necessarily if you want to call it analytics, you know, but whatever you want to call it. You know, when you get into different functional groups where you get into salary cap and contract management, where you get into the, you know, obviously the play-by-play kind of stuff and the game, you know, the in-game kind of stuff, roster construction, you know, your personnel departments, your draft, your scouting. It's surprising to me that there's not more that's invested in that in terms of some of the quote unquote analytics departments are just, you know, having more of a staff to do it. You know, from a contract perspective, most teams have like one or two guys working there. And I don't think most of the teams, make enough use of the other resources that they have. And some of that, you know, when it comes to the salary cap stuff, some of that, actually a lot of it comes to handholding. I think I've shared this story on here before, but, you know, Nick made those wonderful calculators that we have on OTC. And I know one of the teams that uses them, or at least used to use them, I think they still do, you know, they had tried to develop their own. And they hired somebody to do it, to build it, and to make something, and, you know, it didn't really work. Part of the reason why is you can have all the technical knowledge in the world, but if someone isn't there to hold your hand and explain how this stuff works and what it means, it's like there's not a lot that can necessarily get done with it. So when it comes to building stuff, you know, you need some handholding that goes on with some of the things. Other stuff, you know, where you're just talking about big data dumps of things, you know, people might find some really interesting insights that you wouldn't have thought of, but you do have to explain what some of the stuff means, you know, what some of the things might be and what some of the things are. But it's always surprising because it's a job that basically pays for itself, right? You know, just in terms of building a roster, without getting into the, you know, you want to call it the money ball aspect, you know, I kind of dislike that term. I think there's terms that have become kind of bad buzzwords around sports. I think money ball is, because I think people take it for a negative a lot of times. And I think the word analytics has now become a big negative around the NFL. It's almost like a battle. It's like the same silly stuff that we see in politics sometimes, where you dig your heels in on some of the dumbest of things, and analytics has kind of become that thing. You know, analytics is something that's gone on in the NFL for ages. You know, you go back to just people watching film and trying to pick up tendencies. I mean, that's analytics. But it just surprises me that you don't see these investments. You're talking about athletes that make millions and millions and millions of dollars. And if you hire people, if you hire four people for $75,000 a year, just throw a number out there, it could be more, it could be less. You know, the NFL is weird with pay stuff. And you might say, wow, how can we put $400,000 towards the people doing salary cap analysis, and, you know, even if it's cross-functional, like that, we're going to have them work on contract stuff. Like, we got negotiators to do that. But, you know, if those people can help you find a different talent that's maybe a little bit cheaper, or give you a little bit of an edge in a negotiation itself that saves you a couple of dollars, it is not hard to, you know, get your money back on that investment. Right? Because the contracts themselves are so big that if you can find a little bit of an edge that saves you on these multi-million dollar deals, you know, $200,000 per season, $500,000 per season on some of these bigger deals, well, they've more than paid for their own salaries and their services. Now, if you hire these people for different functional departments and you give them cross-functional responsibilities, you know, you build your departments out more and you do that, and you get one home playoff game that you wouldn't have probably gotten before because of the way that you constructed your roster, those four people have certainly more than paid for their salaries just by getting you that. So it's kind of weird the way the NFL kind of picks and chooses as to where they spend their money, because the different types of support I think that the NFL can bring in, as long as they're willing to utilize it, and as long as they're willing to, you know, integrate it, you know, in a way that, I don't know, that basically has people there to help communicate it and explain certain things that are there. I would just think that those teams would do so much better, and it would easily pay for itself. But anyway, that's off the topic of that. It was a pretty good podcast episode. It was just kind of, it was different because it was pretty in-depth, I think, on all the teams, you know, that he was kind of looking at there as the best and the worst teams. And, you know, I just thought it was a pretty cool look at that. So check that out if you get a chance this week. And maybe I'll piggyback off that at some point in time this summer. When, you know, we do some stuff, you know, eventually we will get into looking at some of the franchise players and maybe a couple guys for extensions. Maybe we'll talk about them a little bit as well before obviously make a turn to free agency next fall. You know, I think one of the main things really that I just wanted to go over here is just it was a couple questions that I got on Twitter this afternoon. And it's something that I think confuses a lot of people. And that's the word restructure and renegotiation. They're two very different things. And the way that it's reported widely, you know, by the ESPN, NFL Network groups, is it does a disservice to the NFL fan, or at least it paints a picture that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And here's the thing. A restructure in the NFL is almost automatic. All a restructure is it's a change in the way that we account for the money on the salary cap. There's no fundamental change to the contract. There's no modification to the contract, for the most part. I mean, technically there is. But all you're doing is you're basically saying, we are going to convert your $10 million that you're going to earn anyway into a $1 million salary and a $9 million signing bonus. And this way we can prorate that signing bonus over the course of the contract. Almost every contract in the NFL for a veteran, and this isn't the case for the rookies because it's not allowed, but almost every contract for a veteran in the NFL has an automatic conversion clause. What those clauses basically state is something along the lines of the club has the unilateral right, but not obligation, to convert any amount of paragraph five salary, off-season roster bonus, maybe off-season workout bonus, probably not as much on the workout front. They probably have the right to guarantee the workout. That might be it. The prorates as well. You know, basically anything that could be paid to the player, they have the right to convert it to a signing bonus. And what they will do is that they'll spell out the terms of that signing bonus, and the terms of that signing bonus will simply mimic whatever the terms are of the regular salary. So in other words, if it was a signing bonus that's going to be paid to a player for paragraph five salary that normally would be paid over 17 weeks, I guess now they're paid over 34 weeks, I think, it would follow that same payment schedule. So there would be no difference whatsoever. And then you would basically have an addendum in the contract where it basically has the language that's going to come with the signing bonus. The main thing for an agent to check in that regard is to make sure that the signing bonus language does not include forfeiture, that it just includes forfeiture for that season, because otherwise you're kind of opening yourself up to possible problems. And there's some people who don't catch that. But, you know, there's basically an addendum on there that spells that out, has all the stuff, and you agree ahead of time that if they're going to invoke this, they're going to send you this modification that you have to sign, and you've already pre-agreed to sign it, so you're signing it. It's not, there's nothing really new about it. It's just a schedule on it. So you've agreed to that modification. These things are always reported as if there is like this grand gesture that goes on between the player and the organization, that the player is willing to restructure his contract for the benefit of the team. And it's not even remotely close to the truth. They don't have a choice. And in many cases, they wouldn't not agree to it, because what difference does it make? They don't care. They're getting their money either way. Now, there might be some reasons why you wouldn't want to agree to it, but you don't have a choice. You still end up doing it. So these things are baked in. What you can't do is you can't basically make a material change to the contract. You can't go in there and cut someone's salary. You can't go in there and change when you're going to pay it, you know, in terms of year. You can't say, well, I'm going to take $2 million of the 2021 salary and I'm going to throw that in 2022. That you can't do. That would be against the contract. That would be, you have to negotiate that. You have to renegotiate that deal at that point. You can't just add random years on there, even if they're void years, if they're not already existing in the contract. And I think that's actually something that we're going to see more of in the future, so you don't actually have to go and ask the player to add void years, because that would be something where you have to ask them to do it, that you just bake those in when you first sign it, kind of like Dak Prescott. It's like Dak Prescott has void years with no proration in them. They're only there for the purpose of wanting to restructure the deal, and not actually have to go to him and say, hey, buddy, listen, we need to add another year on your contract. Don't worry, it's a fake year. It'll just void, yada, yada, yada. You don't have to go through that. The reason that you don't want to go through that is because it is for the benefit of the team to restructure in terms of what they're looking to do for the team. So what used to happen in the past is the teams did not have these automatic clauses for a contract restructure. And what would happen is the team would be, you know, up a creek with their salary cap. The salary cap was like a mess. And they would go to the agent and say, hey, look, we need to restructure guys' contract. You know, is this okay? And he would look at that salary cap situation and say, well, no. You know, if you want us to restructure the deal to benefit the team, well, you need to give us a kicker. You know, you're going to pay us an extra $1 million to do it, or you're going to guarantee a portion of the salary. You know, when you see some crazy deals in the past, like a, who would be like a Marshall Faulk or something, who probably lasted technically in the NFL for years beyond when he actually played. It was because of modifications that had to get done, I think, in restructures of that deal, where they just had to keep giving him more money in order to get him to do it. You know, the other issue is that agencies control a large number of players on a team. You know, in the NFL, you know, like Rosenhaus, you know, the Rosenhaus brothers have a bazillion clients. You know, Athletes First, CAA, you know, these are your big organizations, your big groups. If a team is looking for cap relief to try to cut one of your players, your other players, well, you're not going to do that. Why would you do that? You know, so you avoid those by putting these automatic clauses into the contract. So that's why those exist. But that's very different than a renegotiation. I think the reason this was brought up now was because of the Jets with Jamison Crowder, who basically has not been participating in OTAs simply because, as they said, they're working through a contractual matter. Now, he only has one season left on his contract. He's a bit down, I think, on where they would be for the wide receivers on the depth chart. So my assumption is they're looking to give him a pay cut. That's not a restructure. That's a renegotiation. They have to agree to a new deal in which they will pay him less money. Or, I mean, I guess they could be looking to extend him. That would not seem to fit with anything the Jets are doing right now. My guess is what they're doing is they're looking to cut his salary down to probably about $5.5 million. They'll guarantee $5 million of it for the year. You know, there'll be $500,000 still in per game bonuses. They'll guarantee the full five. And I don't think they'll give him a no trade. What that would do is that would make him much more attractive to trade once the regular season kicks off and teams kind of find out if they're a winning organization or a losing one. You know, if you're a team that's sitting there at 5-3 and you've got a weakness at wide receiver, you might look at someone like Crowder now who's cheap because you got him to agree to a pay cut, to where you're only going to have to pick up probably $3 million of the salary for the rest of the year. You'll make that trade for him before the deadline. But if the salary is $10 million and you're going to owe $8 million or $7 million of it, $6 million, whatever the number might be, you might not be making that same trade. But that's a renegotiation. That is coming up with a new contract, completely new terms. The Jets wouldn't have the unilateral right to just do it. But the two terms get so mixed up, and you know it's a better job should be done with it. Let's put it that way, because sometimes it paints players in a bad light. Sometimes it paints organizations in a bad light, and it really shouldn't happen that way. Now, some people had asked me about Tyreek Hill, and I know I had mentioned that on the podcast before, and he said he turned down a restructure. You know, he turned that down. You know, my assumption for that is they needed void years, because I think he only has 2 years left in his deal. So you're not really going to get much cap relief by doing that. They might have deferred a little bit of money too. Maybe they were looking to do that. But more likely they were looking to add like 2 void years onto the contract. And he said no. Now, why would you say no to that? That's a tough call, unless it would somehow reduce your franchise tag number. Again, there's really not a reason to. You know, maybe you think, and this is a slim possibility, but you might think that it hurts you in some way, shape, or form in the future. You know, you do have dead money that's baked in there. Maybe that makes that cap situation worse for the team. So when you're looking for an extension, they're going to tell you that they don't have enough money to do it. Maybe something like that. I don't know. Could just be having to go through some of the nonsense that goes with it. You may have to, you know, retake a physical. Maybe you don't want to retake a physical. You know, I'm not really sure. I don't know if you actually have to retake a physical or not. But, you know, just little things like that would come in. But in general, teams just have the right to do it. You know, that's why when people have talked about like the Julio Jones thing, and it's like, well, they need to restructure. You know, he has to agree to restructure. Not really. I mean, you do need the room to trade for him first, but then you could just restructure him automatically the next day. Now, you could probably get Atlanta to do it. I don't know. See, some of the conversion clauses, there's two ways that you can do it, and I'm not sure how they have them in there. You can do the signing bonus conversion. There are other ones where you can guarantee salary. Basically, that would turn it into a signing bonus in a sense. And that you might be able to defer the timing on, but otherwise they'd have to renegotiate it to change that if they actually needed to do something to restructure the deal ahead of time with the team that's trading for him, taking on all the money. If they had a change of term, like throwing a roster bonus in there. That would be paid, you know, 2 weeks after the trade. So it would bring that cap number down immediately for the trade, but it wouldn't actually be the responsibility of the Atlanta Falcons the way a signing bonus would. There are a couple different ways around it, but the technical restructure just can take place whenever, and no questions really asked about it. Send it. You got to sign it, and away you go. You know, that's pretty much it. So I just wanted to bring that up only because you get so many questions about it, and it just, I don't know, it just kind of annoys me because it's just, I don't know if lazy is the right word. It's just, you should, I don't know, just take the time to just explain what it actually is. You know, when you have a big outlet and you have a big voice and you have a lot of people who are interested in learning about football and understanding certain things about football, you should do your best to communicate it. And if you don't know it, have somebody who does, you know, communicate it. Don't just state some line that you got from an agent or just make something up out of the blue because it sounds good and you're looking to endear yourself to a specific person or persons. You know, I think it's very poorly done right now when we talk about restructures of contracts and what that actually entails. So I just wanted to talk about that for a little bit, just because it's kind of a pet peeve, and I'm sure it will continue to be a pet peeve of mine for quite some time. Let's take a look now at questions. So we're just going to do this as basically a Q&A kind of show. All right. K. Pama says, if a player has an incentive contract, how does that affect his cap hit? For example, if a team has $10 million left under the cap this year, could they offer Richard Sherman a one-year deal with $10 million base, but potentially more if he is an all-pro, or would that put them over? So, yeah, you can do that. So the way the incentive works is if the player reached that threshold for whatever the incentive is last year, then it would count. So if Richard Sherman was an all-pro last year, it would count on the salary cap. Then you wouldn't be able to sign him. You wouldn't have enough space. Typically, you know, you don't do that. You would make sure that the incentive was not something that was earned last year, or you would put in a very easy to achieve team incentive in there that would keep it what's called not likely to be earned. So it would not count on the cap, but in reality is a condition that is going to be very hard for the team not to meet. Basically what it would require is something like, you know, if you were talking about a defensive player, you know, defensive player might have to show the team might have to show improvement in passing yards per game, or the team has to show defensive improvement in touchdowns allowed per game, or the team has to show defensive improvement in interceptions, or the team has to show improvement in defensive tackles. I'm not sure if that one tackles probably holds up, or they have to show an improvement in sacks. You know, you will put in something in there that's very easily achievable to make sure that that's not on the cap for this year, but that the player, you know, if he becomes all pro, will definitely earn it. So incentives are definitely a thing that teams utilize to work around the cap. You know, San Francisco did an incentive with Weston Richburg in the event that he decided not to retire. You know, if things worked out different for him and he did not retire, they had a conditional incentive in there that would have been impossible for him to not earn the full amount. But what they were able to do was to get him, you know, to basically count on the salary cap, the minimum salary, while, you know, they waited to make sure he was going to retire. It was pretty creative. I liked it. You know, and there's other teams that have done some stuff like that too. So, you know, it was, you know, kind of cool that way, you know, for just different things that certain teams might do. So that's a good question, but that's, definitely something. Let's see here. Humbaba says, if the hit rate is around 50% for top 10 picks, which five picks, in your opinion, won't be successful? All right, let's pull up the draft here. And that is pretty much right around the hit rate on it. Okay, so if I had a guess, you know, just based on kind of historical trends, because as I say, I don't really know much necessarily about the players. Let's see, we've got three quarterbacks, one tight end, three wide receivers, an offensive tackle, and a cornerback. So of the three quarterbacks, probably one will hit, two will bust. Which of those it will be? I hope it is Zach Wilson. The Jets' luck in the draft is awful. The Jaguars' luck in the draft is awful. So it'll probably be Trey Lance. But hopefully it will be Zach Wilson, but you'll probably get one. And then two will flop. So let's say Lawrence and Lance are a bust. This way I can say that the Jets got it right. So that's two. The tackle should be a hit. That's a huge hit rate at the top. They're probably a, you know, an 80% hit rate. Your wide receivers are probably 50%. So let's say one wide receiver will bust. I don't know which one that will be. Based on what they have in place right now, I would say Miami or the ones drafted by Miami and Philadelphia probably carry the most risk because the personnel around there might not be great. You know, who knows what Tua is, who knows what Hurts is. And obviously that's going to impact your wide receiver play. So I don't know which of the two that will be, but let's say the Bengals one hits and I don't know. I'll just go with the lower of the picks. I'll say Smith will be the bust from there. You've got the two corners. Most likely one hits, one busts. I'm going to say Denver's will bust only because Denver, I think, screwed up by not taking a quarterback there. As did Carolina. I mean, Carolina screwed up too. But I think Denver screwed up even more because that's a better organization. I shouldn't say that, but I would have expected more from them to do that. Carolina, I think, already cast their lot when they made that trade. So let's see if that's five. So that's two quarterbacks we've got, one wide receiver, one corner. Oh, and the tight end. I would say that would be the other likely one. You know, the expectations for him are going to be so high. I think that's going to be near impossible to meet. You know, I think that will be the case. So I think you will be looking at three of the top four picks, probably ending up being disappointing. It might not be an outright bust, but disappointing. You will probably have one cornerback be good, one cornerback be eh. Tackle should be fine. And of the wide receivers, I would guess you will get one that's really good, one who's good enough, and one who's probably a mess. From that group, I think that would kind of fill historically what teams do or how the players perform. So that would just be my guess at it as to which ones will and won't do well. But I'm hoping it's Zach Wilson is the hit. So we're gonna say he's gonna be the hit, and the guys around him are gonna flop. Burn Bengal, maybe a bit basic, but a cap for dummy segment. For example, how do signing bonuses affect the cap? So what I would recommend to anybody who's really interested in learning on this, check out the book that I did with VJ, Crunching Numbers. You can find that on Amazon. I think it's linked in my bio, maybe. I'm not sure. It might be the website that's there, and I'm not even sure if we still have that up. Almost every sale that we've ever had from that book, I think, pretty much comes from Amazon. I would check it out. Now, the CBA itself has changed. So there are some rules that are a little bit different than what's in the book. But in terms of the contract stuff, with the exception of the terminology such as minimum salary benefit now being a veteran salary benefit, the rules are by and large the same when it comes to salary cap stuff. So if you're really interested in that, I would take a look at that, because all the stuff still holds up, stands up when it comes to negotiating player contracts and contract terms and the way that the salary cap hits work. You know, if you really want to get deep in the weeds on your 30% rules and Dion rules, all that stuff is still there. None of that has changed. The stuff that's different is like revenue calculations, certain things that regarding benefits and suspensions and stuff like that. There's new rules about roster sizes. But the basics, the meat and potatoes of the contract stuff is still in there. You know, the basic stuff when it comes to the salary cap, I mean, really the main thing is you just need to know just a couple of terms. And if you follow along with what we do on OTC, basically what you have are the paragraph 5 salary, which we call the base salary, because I knew paragraph 5, I thought would always just cause confusion. So I never put P5 on there going back to the Jets cap days. So always a base salary is what we would consider the salary that a team is paid in the regular season. You know, and just know that always counts in full against salary cap. Off-season roster bonuses, you know, those are bonuses that are paid for being on the roster at a certain date. Per-game bonuses, which are paid for actually playing in a game or being active for a game. I shouldn't say playing in a game, just being active for that game. Workout bonuses, which are, you know, for working out in the off-season. And then a signing bonus, which is the only part that really doesn't count in full. Technically, there's some other things that don't, but in general, a signing bonus is the only thing that does not count in full. And what you do is you simply take that signing bonus, you divide it by the length of the years of the contract up to a maximum of 5 years. And that's how that counts on the salary cap. And if a player is released and they still have some of that prorated money, that's what we'll see is prorated money on the website. That will jump right up onto your salary cap. When the player is released, you still have to account for that signing bonus money that you paid, but you deferred to later years in that. So, I mean, that's just a real, real, real basic, you know, kind of stuff on it. But I'd recommend trying out the book. It's not that expensive. You know, it's most of the teams have copies of it. And one day we'll get around to another version of it. I just don't know when. If EJ's pretty busy, I'm pretty busy. So, hopefully we will get to it, but I don't know exactly when. Jack says, can you do a deep dive on the Browns cap and strategy? Good version of the story is spending smart free agent money, signing the right guys for big money with creative structures. Bad version, too high on some guys, keeping OBJ, Jarvis might bite them. I'd say give it one more year, paying some guys too much. So, all right. So just on a couple of things with that, let me pull up the Browns real quick here. Let me pull up their salary cap, and then I will pull up their contracts. So here is the one thing that I do not like about Cleveland. The thing that I do not like about Cleveland whatsoever right now is they just jumped headfirst into these void years. This started last year. It still continues now. There was no reason to do it. I dislike it. I'm not a fan of it. Look, void years have a place. Deferring money beyond a contract, there's a time and a place for it. All right. Yeah. The value of a dollar tomorrow is much less than the value of a dollar today if you're looking to maximize the resources on your team. They could have maximized the resources on their team without burying dead money into the future. When you use dead money, avoid years, that's going to lead to dead money for too many players, it doesn't become a question of, well, you know, we might extend those guys. We might not actually pay for it on the cap, or, you know, it won't be a big deal. It's only one guy. Two, you're not going to be able to avoid being way ahead of the rest of the league in terms of dead money. So I'm not a big fan of it. It's a tactic that was used by Philadelphia. They've brought it over. And I, like I said, I can understand the reasons you would do it in some cases. I do not like it as a base functionality of building a team in the NFL. I think it's a downright mistake, and it makes it too easy to trip yourself up. You know, Philadelphia, like I said, I always will say that I think they're one of the smartest organizations in the NFL. I think they're one of the best run organizations in the NFL. They went way too deep with that stuff. And even though people are going to say, well, the reason their cap is so bad right now is because of the pandemic, their cap was going to be bad regardless. It went from being like bad to being catastrophe because of the pandemic. But you already saw the writing on the wall for where this was coming, where it was headed. You know, you need all these players when you keep using and using and using and using this. You need all these players to exceed expectations, to exceed any type of past performance that you would measure from any comparable players in league history. Again, you might get one. You're not going to get 10. It just leaves you with a bad spot when these players start getting older or they become less effective. So that's one that I disliked. Same goes with the Myles Garrett contract. I thought that was too aggressive. Now, they were probably looking to get in before Bosa. So I guess from that perspective, I understand why they did it. I don't think Garrett was coming off a time frame where you necessarily needed to go to 25. And again, what concerns me on this is the structure. Now, you're going to say, well, the salary cap is expected to rise. You know, they structured this deal in a sense of it was going to really become massive, or much more massive beginning in 2023, which is when everyone expected the TV money to kick in. Yeah, I'm fine with that. I can buy that logic. But when you get into the signing and option bonus state, which is what they did here, you leave yourself, again, if a player underperforms, you leave yourself with no leeway whatsoever to do anything with the contract. You know, you just look at these numbers, and this doesn't even count the vesting guarantees, which are, I got to look. No, they're probably same year that you have those guarantees kick in. But basically, the cost to cut, if you look at this starting next year, 48, 35, 23, and then 11.4. So those last 2 years are fine. But these front end years, it's basically immovable. You know, it is an immovable contract. And it's a contract that you might open yourself up to restructure, and then it becomes even more immovable, you know, in that 2025 year where you've got 11.3 dead, you know, it becomes immovable. It's similar, I would say, to what's happened with Dallas with DeMarcus Lawrence, you know, where his contract basically became over time, I think, immovable. Like, it becomes to the point where it's very difficult to do anything. You know, at this point now, DeMarcus Lawrence next year would be $19 million on the cap to cut. And if they go in there and they need to restructure again for cap relief, which they're probably going to have to do because it counts $27 million on the cap, and their cap is in rough shape even after they redo Dak next year. Now, this $11 million number that's sitting there in 2023 is going to skyrocket. That's the last year of his deal. And you're going to be adding more on these void years. You got one void year with already $3 million sitting in there. How much more are you going to put in it? You know, DeMarcus Lawrence played 50% of the snaps last year, 63%. You know, the year before, is he a good player? Yeah, he's a good player. He's not a $20 million player. But the way his contract is done and what they've done with it, you know, he's locked in. You know, this is one of those deals that I don't think gets enough of a look. Not because of what was done initially, but I think what was done probably after the fact, because I don't think they had an option in this one. You know what? Let me just make sure. Let me make sure that I'm not mistaken on this. But I'm pretty sure that this was that this has been that way. Sorry, I'm getting a update notice here. I have no idea why. DeMarcus Lawrence. I'm just looking up his contract history here on my end. Yeah, he didn't have an option. He had a signing bonus. So there was a 25 to sign, and then the next year they jumped in and they converted $15 million. Now, they were able to not do it this year, which was smart. But, you know, they turned it into a rougher contract. And I think that's one of the things that I would look at with Myles Garrett. The Beckham Landry deal, I think the same thing. I think that's wishful thinking on their part. Now, you want to give your young quarterback every opportunity to succeed. You don't want to have it go in the other direction, you know, to where you are, I don't know, that where you might be taking away something to where if he has a bad year, people start to say, well, he had a bad year because they dumped one of their wide receivers. You know, that's fine. You know, some of the stuff they do here, I mean, the Kareem Hunt stuff is really good. That's a really good deal that they got. You know, they I'm just looking through here at other ones that they signed. Safety deal is okay. Conklin's a little pricey, but that's okay. Clowney is for $8 million. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Case Keenum's a backup. They traded for him, I think. Troy Hill is a steal at 4.5. You know, that's a good deal. I think that's a good way to build. I think that's a good investment that they've made in their secondary with some of the things that they've done through the draft and how they're building that secondary, utilizing draft and free agency. Sorry, this is a little disjointed. I'm just kind of going through some things here. The McKinley Malik Jackson moves to me are, those are Eagle moves. All right. That's a very much bet on talent, bet on name, don't bet on recent production. Jackson at 3.8, that's, I guess, okay. You know, he's worth more than that. So I probably shouldn't put him in that category. You know, I think there is an injury risk there, and he's only a part-time player. I think where they are, they probably could have gotten somebody younger, but I don't know. That's just a little bit on that. That one's not as bad. The McKinley one, I'm not high on at all. 4.25. I mean, he's a bust. I mean, but that's a pure bet on talent kind of player. Wasn't a big fan of the Njoku option pickup. My guess is they're holding on to him, hoping they can trade him, or that they are looking to see the concept of someone will spend up for him the following year and they'll get a compensatory pick. You know, maybe that's a possibility. The Austin Hooper deal is terrible. That's just not good. You know, I don't know what they saw there. It's like they're running. It's a very different thing that you've got going on in Atlanta. You weren't going to have that going on in Cleveland. There was no reason to make him the highest paid tight end in the NFL. You know, that was just, I don't know. I think that one was a mistake. You know, in terms, I think, of organizational structure, I think from everything you hear, I think it's terrific. You know, I think they've brought over the Eagle way that I talk about that I think is really good, you know, but I do think you're going to see some of those same tendencies as well, where you get into stuff with the void years, you get into stuff with some contracts where you are overly bullish, probably on your own players. And for the Eagles, you know, that becomes a problem. It becomes a problem when you're taking a 30-year-old and extending him, you know, just for the hell of it, you know, because you need salary cap relief or something. So, you know, it's hard to tell because they're still so early in their tenure. And it's like you've almost got, it's like they you've been given as an organization a bit of a head start because of how much cap space was cleared out kind of before, you know, and some of the personnel that's in place. You know, I think that's one of the things. I can see my daughter has made her way down here. Hi. Yes. Hello, Megan. That's Megan's first appearance on the podcast in probably, I don't know, probably since I did this with Bryce, which was probably like 6 years ago, when we used to do a couple of these. And then I didn't do them for a pretty long time, but Megan was maybe four or five. Megan would occasionally make some little guest appearances, popping on the podcast. So I guess she is back. I'm not sure if her brother will make it down. He fell asleep on the couch again, he's awake. Good. So that means he can walk upstairs on his own because I certainly can't carry him. That was tough. Last week carrying him up the stairs. Oof. That is a tough one, to do. And no, Nellie does not talk, Megan.
Yeah. Nellie says hello. But she's not quiet.
All right. Anyway, so we'll see. I'm sure we'll have some Megan noise in the background now, too. So anyway, but that's just some quick thoughts on Cleveland right now. Even Quinn says, hey, Jason, what happens to a rookie who gets injured at voluntary offseason workouts before having signed a contract? Hypothetically, Mac Jones, for example, their protections for these players, especially guys drafted in later rounds. So typically what happens is the teams and the agents will agree to a waiver. Waivers probably not the right word. They will agree to basically certain types of terms, you know, participation agreement or participation contract, you know, something that basically spells out what will happen if the player gets injured. And typically what that means is the injury, you know, basically they will agree to the basic terms that would occur in the regular contract, even if the player gets injured. So typically that's what they are. What they don't have is maybe you don't have the, you know, the official stuff in terms of, you know, forfeiture languages, guarantee language, when your signing bonus is being paid out. You know, it's basically like I would guess, you know, like a letter of intent kind of deal, you know, which, you know, there's basically something to it. But that's what they do. And even for the teams where that, you know, it's been a little bit limited, I've never heard of a player not getting his full deal that's expected of him simply because he got injured there. I mean, that's one of those things everybody seems to go with. Should the Jets try and sign Steve Nelson? I don't know why he hasn't been signed. I'm not saying by the Jets. I'm just saying in general. Look, the Jets need secondary help. I don't know what they're doing in the secondary. I guess they're just going to try a bunch of young guys and see what happens. And who knows? Maybe it'll work out. Maybe they got some hidden gems there. But I don't know. You know, I don't know if the Jets are gun shy. You know, the Jets have made some bad signings with some of these veteran players that really haven't worked out that they thought would provide veteran leadership and a steady hand, whatever. And they've all pretty much stunk. So maybe they've just decided that that's a waste to go that route. You know, I would probably try to add a couple of veteran guys, but I don't know. I think they might be happy with what they have. And it's not as if, the expectation for the Jets is so high this year to where I think you're like, oh, they need to add it. It's probably more a realization of this is probably our last year where you kind of have a developmental year of sorts. So maybe they look at it like, we're not going to punch up at cornerback this year, or we're not even going to waste the effort on signing players at that position where we know sometimes the period that they might be effective is pretty short window. We probably want to reserve doing that until next year. See what we've got this year with whatever young guys that we've collected, throw them out there, see how bad they might be or how good they might be. And then next year in free agency, we can spend because we should be a competitive team next year. And at that point, it's beneficial for us to have players in the secondary that we're going to pay up on in hopes that they can keep performing at a reasonable level. So I think that is that's probably what the Jets are thinking. Neil says, go over the veteran salary benefit, an interesting topic that isn't discussed much. It can coincide with the discussion on why players wait to sign until camp, waiting for injuries, don't want to risk injury at minicamp, et cetera. So, okay, so the veteran salary benefit used to be called the minimum salary benefit. Basically, what it allows you to do is to sign a player to a contract but not count the full salary against the salary cap. As long as you pay the player the minimum salary that his years allow him to get, I think that's this year, I think that's either $990,000 if you've been in the league for 4 years. And I think it's $1.075 million if you've been in the league 7 years. So basically what it is that charge, instead of counting at $990,000 or $1.075 million, it'll only count at $850,000. So you save yourself a little bit of money by doing that. And basically, it also saves you a little bit more money because it gives the team leverage because you can go to the player and maybe the player is expecting something like a $1.5 million offer. And you can say, listen, we can only do a veteran salary benefit contract. And that means that we can only give you $137,500 as bonuses. You know, we can't give you a $500,000 bonus. We can't give you a chance to earn an incentive that's $500,000. This is all we can offer. Because if we do this, you qualify on this veteran salary benefit, and we know we're not going to have a problem with the salary cap then. So it's also a way for teams to kind of create leverage with it. The original concept of the minimum salary benefit was something that was designed to keep players in the league. Because what happened in the early days of the salary cap was the feeling that veteran players were going to be pinched from the league because they earned too much money based on the minimums. So, in other words, there might have been a point in time where when you had a much lower salary cap, for example, Let's say a player with 9 years in the league, they had more groups than 4 to 6, 7 plus. It was like 4 to 6, 7 to 9, and 10 plus years. And let's say that 10 plus years meant you were going to earn $950,000. But a second year player in the NFL, or a third year player in the NFL, was only going to earn $500,000. And the salary cap that year was only, say, $100 million or something, or $120 million. Well, you know, that big difference between the two really put the veteran in some cases in danger of not keeping a job. Now, the benefit is so tiny. It's like, what's the point? You know, $850 to $990, you know, nobody's going to care about that. Teams have also just gotten very negative on older players around the league, and rightfully so. I mean, the stuff pretty much tells you that the older players, there's very limited upside to the older players. They're very much role specific. You know, it's not a long-term kind of thing. They might be stunting the development, not intentionally, but just by taking snaps from younger players. So I don't think the veteran salary benefit at this point actually serves any purpose for anybody, with the exception of it being a leverage play by NFL teams to simply say, this is all we can offer you. And the reason that this is all we can offer you is because of this, you know, because of this rule that's in place. You know, it's kind of a bunch of baloney, but I think that that's kind of one of the things that happens. As for why do players wait to sign until camp, you know, I think it is, I don't think it's the risk of injury, you know, that you mentioned, because if they get hurt, their salary is protected. But I think the first thing that you brought up about waiting for injuries, I think that is something, you know, because here where I'm talking about the veteran salary benefit being something where, you know, you're locked in on a salary and you don't really have another choice. Well, let's say, you know, for example, a player like a Steven Nelson that was mentioned before. Let's say your options right now are the Jets are on the table with a minimum salary, a veteran salary benefit offer. Sorry, I'm so used to calling it a minimum salary benefit, the MSB, that I'm always going to slip into doing that. That's all you have on the table. Jets aren't really expected to be good. You're probably not going to get a lot of publicity for playing on the Jets. It doesn't give you a chance to reinvent yourself in the rare instances where you're able to kind of recover yourself. So you are looking for something else. So let's say that he has an opportunity to go to Kansas City again. You know, in that case, let's say somebody gets hurt and, you know, they really need a corner. Maybe they offer $2 million because they're in desperate need of a cornerback. Or, you know, maybe they only offer you the minimum salary, you know, the veteran salary benefit deal, but that's a high profile team. You know, that's a team that's going to be on primetime a lot. That's a team that's expected to be in the playoffs. That's a team that's expected to be in the Super Bowl. So you have an opportunity to kind of reinvent yourself by going to that type of team. So I think that's one of the reasons why it makes sense. Some players don't like to do camp. Now, you can't really pick and choose, I think, when you're in that position to where it's like, I don't feel like doing training camp. You know, you do need to get a job. But I think a lot of it is that, you know, you want to be able to find the best possible fit for you to where you have the best opportunity to A, make the team, and B, reinvent yourself as a player to where maybe you can jump back in and have an opportunity to earn $3 million, $4 million again in the future rather than being stuck on this. All right. And I just saw I had some email questions. So let me run on those and then I'll go back to Twitter. Okay. So Turner says, what could happen is a hypothetical. What could happen if the NFL had a massive cap rise, just like the NBA had in 2016? What teams would take the most advantage and what teams would make the biggest mistakes? Any other potential ramifications? All the current players would want new contracts, right? So if you had a massive cap rise, this did happen before, okay? This happened between 2006 and 2007. The salary cap rose from, I don't know, 60 to 86. No, it wasn't 60 to 86. 67 to 80? I don't remember. It was a giant jump when you consider where the salary cap was. And it was a jump that was so big, it fundamentally changed a lot of stuff with contracts. It immediately started to spike numbers in terms of where the financials went. Would players ask for new deals? They would. They would have no leverage to get it. You know, that's one of the things where you have to decide what's best for you as a player next year in free agency, because realistically, 2023 has potential to be much bigger with the salary cap. Well, definitely much bigger with the salary cap than 2022. And if you might get that big jump because of the television network money, you would rather be a free agent in 2023. Now, just saying, well, you take a one-year deal and then you're going to make more the next year, which is what a lot of people say, is not entirely accurate. You know, if you're 29 years old and someone's offering you $5 million a year, you're going to be 30 next year. That probably works against you far more than the salary cap rising. You know, you're 30 years old. They're not going to offer you $10 million just because the salary cap is increasing. I mean, maybe if you're a really great player, but you know, if you're already at a level where you're like a $5 million player, you know, probably not. But you know, if you're a free agent who's 26, should be a strong consideration. But if you are 28 or older, I'm not sure as much when it comes to that. As for teams that would be in position to make the most of it, I'm always fascinated with the Colts. This would put them in a position where they'd be forced to spend money. The Colts typically don't. So I think I'd be pretty fascinated to see what they would do by being forced to spend more money. Cincinnati, maybe a little bit for similar reason. I think teams that would benefit from it a lot would be teams that like to spend, you know, teams like the Eagles, the Falcons, the Saints, you know, those are the teams that really would get the most out of it, because they're teams that like to go out and spend. Those are probably some of the teams that might make the biggest mistakes. The teams that would make the biggest mistakes with it are probably the teams that still would just go, you know, crazy signing, you know, a whole bunch of free agents to remake the team. You know, the NFL is a league where you want to have the flexibility for every year to have player in, player out, player in, player out. You don't want to have a year where you can't add free agents because your salary cap is screwed. All right. And that might happen to you for whatever reasons, but it should never happen to you because in one year you decided to sign like seven big name free agents. Yeah, it's just recipe for disaster. So those types of teams would screw themselves up. This is from Declan. Today, the Seahawks extended Michael Dickinson at nearly $4 million per year. There seems to be a lot of teams that go for punter, kicker, long snapper on the cheap, and then a few teams like the Seahawks that devote a lot of capital resources to it. What is your opinion on teams spending well over veteran minimums on specialists, especially what these positions are in theory quite replaceable? Will a team ever get $4 million of value out of a punter or kicker? No. It's absolute stupid spending. You know, maybe if you have a guy like a Justin Tucker, you know, if you have a kicker that has a leg where he legitimately can hit these bombs, which are from positions where, you know, typically it's no man's land. You're probably going to punt a ball, or, you know, it's a very near impossible conversion situation. If they can get you 3 points, you know, 80% of the time, 85% of the time from a really long distance, that's worthwhile. A punter is basically worthless. I mean, who cares? You know, I'm sorry for the punters out there. You have a game that's built on scoring. You have a game that's built on needing to move the football. You have a game that's built more and more on going for it on fourth down. It's a game that's built to having field goal kickers that can kick from further and further away. And it's a game that also has so much better offenses that there's no such thing as pinning a team inside the 20 or, you know, playing this magic field position game. Team starts on the 20, they start on the 30, they start on the 25. It doesn't make a difference. It really doesn't. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't. All you need is someone functional back there. Realistically, you should be getting a kicker that can punt. Or you should have your quarterback or backup quarterback punt. You know, be Danny White, be Randall Cunningham. I think Elway did a couple kicks too, right? That's what you want. Maybe even Marino did one. But that's what you should be doing. Why waste a roster spot? Why waste all that money? You know, $4 million on a kicker, you can get yourself a situational pass rusher. You can get yourself a slot corner. You know, what are you doing? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. Yeah, it really doesn't. You know, these couple of deals for kickers and punters are just pointless. Look, if you look at the long snapper market that you mentioned, let me bring up long snappers. See, this to me makes sense, right? You need a long snapper. It's a skill, so you need a specialist to do that. What do the teams pay for long snapper? I'm gonna just read off these salaries. 1.33, that's the highest paid player, Reed Ferguson. John Weeks, 1.2. Texans signed Rex Burkhead. Sorry to jump off tangent. I forgot about that. And they gave him guaranteed money. What are they doing? Houston, what are you doing? Houston, we have a problem. I don't know what that is. All right, Dallas, 1.2. Titans, 1.2. Steelers, 1.2. Notice a trend here. Colts, 1.2. Panthers, 1.2. Bengals, 1.2. Saints, 1.2. Lions, 1.175. Raiders, 1.14. Eagles, 1.13. This is like bare minimum spending. This is, okay, we need a long snapper. We are going to pay the bare minimum to have a long snapper. I don't care if he's a Pro Bowl long snapper. I don't care if he's an All-Pro long snapper. I don't care if he's an awful long snapper. We're paying $1.2 million, $1.1 million for our long snapper. Now you look at punter. So we've got this guy for four, 375, 33, 31, 3 million, 3 million, 3 million, 29, 28, 26. You know, we're seeing a spread. You know, 175, 15, 14, 12, 11, 11, 990, 890. Why in the world is there a spread at this position? Why in the world are you paying $4 million for a punter? What market is there for the punter to be like, oh, I'm going to hit free agency and I'm going to leave? Okay, go leave. When do you hear about these big signings of a punter in free agency? When? Colquitt signed, maybe, I think? Maybe $3 million? Like, who cares? Say, leave then. I'm going to offer you $1.2 million. No, I'm going to go to free agency. Go to free agency. Go let some other sucker pay him $4 million. You know where you'd be better if you were Seattle? If you, one of your rivals, if Arizona went and paid their punter $4 million. You know, that's what you would do. Look at kicker. Let's look at the spread on kicker. 5 million, 4, 6, 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, 3, 4, 3, 4, 2, 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, 3, 8, 3, 8, 3, 6, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 2, 5, 2, 5, 1, 8, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 1. It's like you should be in this 1-1 category. Unless it's Justin Tucker, you should be a 1-1. What are the Giants doing paying $4.7 million to Graham Gano? This guy's been cut. I mean, how many times? Let me look up the Gano contract history here that we've got. So he signs in 2018 with Carolina, right? IR. He's cut. He goes to the Giants for 2-2. They immediately turn around and sign him for 4-7. What are you thinking? What are you doing? So, no, it is terrible strategy to do that. If you could knock off, if you're paying $4 million to your punter and you're paying $4 million to your kicker, right? Is that where Seattle's at? Where's Seattle on their kicker? No, Jason, yeah, 3-8. You're paying $8 million to those two guys. You should be paying a total of about two. That's $6 million. Who could you buy for $6 million? What positions do you want to improve? You know, $6 million would get you a player like a Laken Tomlinson type of guard, Cam Irving. I'm not crazy about that, but it'll give you something more. Zeitler costs $7.5. Glowinski, 5-4. You know, if you needed a center, Alex Mack went for 5 this year. David Andrews went for 4-8. Seattle loves running backs. Get another running back. You know, defensively, I mean, you know, $6 million, you know, that gets you probably to a reasonable, okay defensive tackle. I mean, that's basically what you're paying Puna Ford. You know, Ashawn Robinson gets that. Brandon Williams gets that. Rankins is at 5'5". So, I mean, those are that's what you could add to your team. Contributing players who play 30, 40% of the time. Instead of spending it on a dude that kicks, you know, a dude who punts every now and then, which is a play you never want to have happen. It's like, what's worse than a punt? Like an interception, pick six? I mean, that's what's worse than a punt. You know, it's pointless. It's foolish. If it was me, I would say no punter. No punter at all. Teach somebody to kick. Teach somebody to punt the football. And I'll get the cheapest kicker that there is. That's how I would play it, because that would give you a competitive advantage of some sort over some of these other teams. To be at the high end of the pay scale on both of those positions, asinine. Sorry, Seattle fans. Okay, let's go back to Twitter here. Mark says, you mentioned in the last pod players signing undervalued contracts and the problems that can cause. Any chance the players union wakes up and realizes they made a huge mistake in the last CBA and tries to force it open? Any outs in the agreement that would allow? No, it's a 10-year CBA. It's locked in. There's no changing it. You know, there's no changing that. You already saw that they made up a reason for not going to workouts this year, which they tried to use the pandemic as a logic for it, which wasn't, you know, as a way to get around that, when it would have been very easy to get out of the last CBA, you know, the off-season program. So there's no out. There's no ability for them to do stuff. So basically what you have to have happen at this point is something that occurs, and that something that occurs is enough to cause enough of a firestorm that will cause the league to react and say, okay, we need to address this issue and modify the CBA in like a side letter or something, because we didn't really think about this situation. That's really the only way that you can do it, but there's no way to force out of it. You know, in the short term, it was actually a good thing they signed the CBA, because with the pandemic, it would have been a real mess last year. Because the cap changes would have hit automatically right away. Teams would have been slashing payroll left and right. So in that sense, it was actually a good thing. In terms of overall, yeah, I think it was a bad deal. Bobby says, so teams structure contracts with the intent to restructure in the future. Seems odd that contracts sometimes just 1 year in would be in line to get restructured to find savings and spending potential. So yeah, that's exactly what they do. So the reason that you do it that way versus when I talked about the Browns before with Myles Garrett, where they put in with like option bonuses, they put in two option bonuses. Teams used to do that in the past. And there's some teams that still kind of did stuff like that. The reason teams moved away from that is, why do you really want to tie yourself in to prorating all this money when maybe the situation will change and you don't have to do that? So for example, with Dak Prescott, obviously his contract is built to be renegotiated or restructured next year, right? You know, he's got a $33.2 million cap hit. They're way over the cap next year, $20 million P5. And they have a void year with no money in it that's just sitting there begging to basically get money from a 2022 contract restructure. So it's there. But the reason why you don't do this ahead of time, this is where, you know, it's smart by a team like Dallas. Instead of saying we're giving them a $1 million P5 with a $19 million option bonus, well, what happens if something occurs to where their salary cap situation changes dramatically? I don't know what that would be. But let's say they had to cut two big price guys and it opened up a lot of cap space. Well, then they can carry Dak at that 33.2. That gives them more flexibility with the next 3 years of his contract. That's the reason why you go ahead and do that. You know, you make these moves. I'm sorry, with the next 2 years of his contract, you make these moves so you have the ability to maintain as much flexibility as possible. You don't want to tie yourself down to a certain way of kind of doing business when it comes to some of these different mechanisms for prorating money. But that's why teams will build these contracts out with these restructures built right in. And that's the reason why. Oh, and just to add to that, so this is one of the problems. You know, people will talk about the restructuring of these deals. they'll talk about how the void year stuff, not a big deal. You know, the Packers added void years to a bunch of deals just now, even one of their RFAs, because they just have nothing. It's not bad. Like in the case of if Dallas does it with Dak, I would say, okay, you know, that's not terrible because they planned it. Like this is what was there. Like if they had done that in the original contract, nobody would complain about it. So I'm not going to complain about it when they actually go ahead and restructure it because it is what it is. The problem is more when you get into the deals which are not designed to be restructured. It's like you set the deal up in a way. You didn't set that deal up in a way to be restructured 10 times. You know, the Steelers with Ben Roethlisberger. You know, the Eagles with many of their recent deals to where you're just throwing void years on it. That's just being a gambler. You know, at that point, you've gone beyond the point of logic and beyond the points of your original intent with a contract and beyond the points of what the intent should be given the information that you have in front of you right now. It's just gambling. It's just like, well, I just need to do this. And that's where teams get into issues, you know, and too many people look at the void years as like a non-issue when in reality, it's a very big issue, you know, for some of these restructures or not even the void years, just the generalized restructure of the deal when it fundamentally changes your out in the contract and you have to look at the numbers on the deal and look to see how they stand, because when you are pushing all this money in, you're functionally guaranteeing more years for that player. You might be able to get to still cut him, and you take a massive dead money hit. But in essence, you're basically virtually guaranteeing that player roster spots. You don't want to do that. Black Gold says, the Jets are asking Crowder to take a pay cut. Sounds stingy enough to earn a bad rep. If he was going to do this all along, making him wait until after free agency for additional leverage, does he get a pass on all the Maccagnan guys, or is this a bad pattern? I don't think this one will be considered a big deal, because I think this was kind of a known. There wasn't going to be this magical great market for Crowder if he cut him earlier on. I think this was just, you knew what was going to happen. You knew that this was going to be the case if you were Jamison Crowder, so I don't think that this one is doing someone bad. I think this one is just looked at probably more as the negative side of the NFL. So I'm not going to look at this one as anything too bad. I do think in terms of getting a pattern here, if he starts to do this with guys that he signs, you know, more and more often, you know, now the Lewis situation, I think he signed him, right? That was a Douglas signing last year, wasn't it? Yeah. So that one, there's extenuating circumstances because of the NFI stuff and all those other things. So I don't think that one was something that he'd be looking at. But yeah, if he starts doing this with other players, it might become a little bit of an issue. Right now, the Jets, I don't think, you know, because of the Adams situation, because of a lot of stuff that's gone on there, you know, Gase takes a lot of the blame for it. But I think there's some bad reputations about the Jets around the league with some of those deals that it's kind of like a two-faced approach right now. Now, I've always said I think this is just Douglas needing to get used to this part of the job, and that sometimes just saying what you think is the right thing is not really the right way to approach it. You know, sometimes you just got to tell the truth or just say nothing at all versus trying to sugarcoat something that's not accurate and then having people come out and contradict you on it. I think is a bad look. But I think he'll get better with that over time. Good old Charlie says, which of these are you picking from 1975? Let's take a look. So this is a lot of desserts here. A lot of snacks for 60 and 65 cents. This reminds me, we get the little ice cream, not ice cream, but the Marty's something or other that comes by. Jacob loves it. And so does Megan. So I do end up getting them once a week. If he drives by the house, we do end up getting a little treat here for them. So of this list, now some of these look probably pretty bad. I'm pretty generic with this. I would probably get a Italian lemon ice. So I'd probably get an Italian ice from this list for 50 cents. Or an ice cream sandwich, a vanilla ice cream sandwich for 45 cents. I don't think I'd get any of these other ones. But yeah. So I think that would be my selection. Kiss them girls and bake them pies. What would a new 2-year deal for Crowder look like that guaranteed him a solid salary for next year, but easily tradable at this year's deadline with a minimum dead money for 2022? They couldn't do that because if they guaranteed him a salary for next year, no one's going to trade for him. Teams are only going to trade for Jameson Crowder because they would get him for a playoff run this year. The Jets paid up for him in free agency, in my opinion. I don't think he was worth 10. Or whatever they paid. I don't think he was even worth close to that. I think they paid up. I think they had a bad year at free agency that year with some of the values they did. I think they paid up for him. I don't think his value around the league is considered anything like that. He's a solid player, steady player. He's been banged up. But I think what the Jets are looking at is they're probably looking at a situation where they're hoping that this could be like Mohamed Sanu or that this could be Emmanuel Sanders. Let me see. What was Sanu got a second round pick from the Patriots. Now he did have a second year, but it was not guaranteed. I'm just going to look up how much he was being paid when they picked him up. Why am I not finding him? There we go. Mohamed Sanu. So Sanu on the Patriots. So the Patriots, so his salary, yeah, $6 million. So the Patriots only had to pick up $3.7 million of it that year. That was a second round pick. Emmanuel Sanders, I think, was a third round pick when he went from Denver to San Francisco, and San Francisco picked up $6 million. That was a bad move it was a bad move for him, but yeah, he was pretty overpriced. But I think that's what the Jets are doing. The Jets are looking to make this very attractive to where team can get him for $4 million for a playoff run. So I think that's what the Jets are looking for. And I think if you guarantee a second year, that changes that and that locks him into you. Michael Becker, best guess on the financial terms Atlanta has to accept in a Julio trade. Are they eating salary? They should not have to eat salary. If they are eating salary to trade Julio Jones, then they shouldn't trade him. You know what? Then don't trade him. Figure out how you're going to work your cap with it. I know I said before, damned if you do, damned if you don't. Don't do it. You know, figure out what you have to do. Mend the fences with them. Get your quarterback to talk to them. That'll probably mend the fences. And, you know, you go out there, do what you can, and then you see what you can get for him at the trade deadline. There is no reason that they should have to pay. This is because teams will look at a couple of bad trades that were made, like the DeAndre Hopkins deal, and they'll do that. The only other reason that there would be to a team to be thinking that they should be getting them to pay that money on it is simply because they think Julio Jones is going to go and he's going to say, well, you know, Hopkins got a new deal. I want a new deal. That's the only way that's going to happen. So, yeah, they'd be foolish to do that. Danny says, has any of the analysis on the AVT trade by the likes of Jeremiah made you change your mind about it being a bad trade? Not a criticism. Just wondering if you can see their point of view or you think it was a bad move. I think it's a bad move. Now, I'm not going to say that I have followed the thoughts on the player. I will just say that every draft analyst in the world will talk very highly of many players. I don't know if you will ever find a top pick in the draft, top 20, top just first round pick, with the exception of the random reaches, where they will tell you, yeah, that guy sucks. You won't see it, right? You've got a list of all these players that they're ranking that they're telling you are going to be a good player. The hit rate in the draft doesn't tell you that there is any magical formula that anyone has found on the you know, college to pro kind of projection. So, you know, maybe they're very high on someone, but they're going to be high on a lot of people. And there's going to be plenty of people that are missed on, you know, when it comes to this stuff. So I just kind of go by the numbers of what you get, the benefits and everything else. But like I've said with anything, all these things are, there is a possibility he'll be fantastic. There is a possibility that will be the case. That still doesn't make it, I still don't even say that would make it necessarily the right trade. Because if you went and you did that again, you know, the next year in the same spot, you would probably whiff pretty badly. Just you know, because of how they typically work out. I can see where a team gets overly aggressive with it, and I can understand why teams do that. And in some cases, for certain positions, I think it makes some sense at least to do. I just can't see how you would do that for a guard. It just, I just don't think that impact is enough. You know, even when you have a dominant player, I don't think the impact on the game is enough. Like, let's say that this guy was great. Let's say he is the greatest guard in the history of the NFL. All right. That's how good he is. Okay. And that certainly is going to justify a trade or whatever. If you had that in front of Sam Darnold, would Sam Darnold have been any good? Would the Jets have made the playoffs? The answer is no. It wouldn't have even been close because the player behind him stunk. You know, the player behind the guard is terrible. You weren't doing anything. Would you have made life a little easier on Sam Darnold? Okay, so instead when he was seeing ghosts, maybe throw three instead of four interceptions. So I think when you break down the impact on the game, how much that is bringing you, that changing your fortunes around, it's very limited. You would get more benefit from getting two starters than one. You would get more benefit by finding skill position players than offensive linemen. So I just think the logic in team building is just even completely off on this. Now, and again, might be a fantastic player. It still doesn't change the fact that when you look at the limited resources that you have to build a team, where are you better off? How are you better off? You know, you create for yourself a much bigger advantage. And I'm not saying the Jets needed to draft a wide receiver. I don't know, but you create for yourself a very big advantage by drafting a position like that. You know, the difference in salary between that pick and, you know, the expected production level that you would get from a wide receiver, you know, that's pretty big. That's money that you can use to go and get a guard. Guards kind of available in free agency. You know, wide receivers are not. Pass rushers are not. It's like you're taking a position that you can probably replace in free agency. You're creating a void to where you may have to find a more expensive position now to replace in free agency. I don't know if that really makes a lot of sense. You know, and when you're giving up, odds are, you know, when you give up those third round picks, odds are you're giving away a starter. You know, from that, it's basically like a 50-50 chance of finding a starter in the third round. So two third round picks, probably going to get you that. You know, you're dropping down in the fourth round, you're taking one shot at it. So your odds are much, much, much lower. So I just think from a team building exercise, it's just not the right move. Now, if you are the Kansas City Chiefs, you've got a complete roster, you think that this roster is complete for the next two seasons, and you desperately need an offensive lineman, okay. I kind of get it, you know, because that for you, for that team that has a expensive quarterback, has expensive receivers, you probably are better off maybe giving away the depth in the draft for 1 year to get a guard rather than having to pay up $16 million for Joe Tooney. So I think if that's the team that you're looking at, you know, depending on where the team is in their, you know, their team building, you know, timeline, you could make more of a justification for a trade like this. For a team that's completely rebuilding, I just don't know. I mean, it is just the pure concept of you need to have this dominant offensive line to ensure your quarterback is successful. The Jets had a great offensive line with Mark Sanchez. Did that make Mark Sanchez successful? You know, they don't really correlate. You know, it's if you have a atrocious offensive line, yeah, it's going to impact your quarterback. If you have an average offensive line, probably going to get pressured only a couple times less than when you've got a great one. I mean, it's just the Jets needed to be at least average on the offensive line. I don't think they have to be dominant because they'd be better off being average on the offensive line and figuring out ways to become dominant on defense or at some of their skill positions to improve their passing game, you know, versus just trading up to become dominant on your offensive line. So it's more that. I mean, it's not just that the trade itself. I mean, the trade itself, I think, is bad, you know, just as a pure valuation of it. But just in terms of team building, you can't look at a big picture because this is drafting a guard is not a big picture. You can't look at the big picture and tell me that that trade is a trade that brings confidence in how they're trying to build a team, at least not in today's NFL. That's just my take on it. Obviously, a lot of people disagree. Mostly Jets fans disagree. But you know what? If that trade was made by any team in the league, I'd be saying the same thing. I just happen to have a lot more people that follow me that are Jets fans because I'm a Jets fan and like to talk about the Jets. Most people say I like to complain about the Jets, but I haven't had anything else to talk about with the Jets for many, many years, just complaints. All right, let's see. Is Chandler Jones holding out? More and more rumors that he is. What would a new contract look like? Gosh, you know, I haven't really heard anything about it. Chandler Jones very well could be. I guess he's towards the end of his deal, right? He's coming off injury. You know, sometimes when you get injured, the next thing you start thinking about is, wait a minute, I need a new deal. Yeah, he's in the last year of his contract. He's making $15.5 million. Let's see. You know, the market at edge rusher has gone way up, but, you know, he's older. I'm just trying to look. You know, Cam Jordan got $17.5 million on an extension. So I would guess he's looking to get to 18. You know, that's just a guess of mine. You know, Jordan's 32. How old is Jones? Jones is probably got to be close to that. 31. Yeah, 31 will be 32. You know, I would guess that's what he's looking for is probably 18 a year, 18, 19 million a year. You know, and it's a tough position to be in. You know, you coming off injury, you know, you look at his numbers here. I'm just pulling up his sack numbers. You know, 11, 15, 13, 19 sacks. Is that right? You know, and then last year he's hurt. And like I said, that injury, especially as you get towards the end of your contract, can kind of become eye-opening and you're like, man, you know, I want a new contract. And given what some of the stuff Arizona's done, maybe he'll get it. Oh, if that's what he's looking for. But I can understand his perspective if that's what he's doing. Reese says, any interesting June 1 news? No. I don't think there was anything interesting that came down this year on June 1st. You know, the couple teams now have room to sign their draft picks. So I think that's pretty much that. Anyway, hope you're doing good. Matt Smith says, is there a generally accepted minimum amount of cap room that teams save for in-season injury replacements, or might certain teams be more aggressive, conservative? Yeah, it depends on the organizations. Like the Rams. Rams used to drop down to like $200,000 in season. There was one year where they got a rash of injuries and they had to restructure a couple contracts in season just to cover those injuries so they could field the first full team. You know, I think the most common number that you look at is probably around 7 million. I know some people will say 10, but I think 7 million is kind of the number that a lot of teams look at as having for the season. That's more than enough of a safety net. It gives you an ability to cover your injuries. It gives you an ability to sign players to an extension. So I think that's kind of the number people look at. Axe asks, what was your first DVD you bought? I really don't know. I didn't buy a lot of DVDs. My first DVD. I really don't know. If I had a guess, I would guess it was probably some Star Wars movie or something. You know, the Empire Strikes Back or a box set or something like that. I really don't remember. I used to go to the movies a little bit. We used to watch a lot of movies. But I don't really recall too much DVD stuff. I don't even remember. When did DVDs really first take over for the VCR kind of tapes? I'm looking up now to see if anything can even jog my memory, because now I'm kind of curious to see what that is. But I can't remember. I really can't. You know, but if I had to guess, I would guess it would be that, you know, it was either Star Wars, Empire, or the box set that of the special editions or something like that that came out, you know. But I can't remember exactly what that was, but I do remember, you know, we had my grandmother had a little TV with the DVD. That was like a big thing that we got her. So I did watch some movies on that when I was over there. But yeah, I can't really recall what that was, but probably some Star Wars stuff. Let's see. Mike says, how is the new influx of network money going to affect the cap? My guess is all 1-year deals are being done to take advantage next year. So the year where it's going to kick up is 2023. I don't know how much that it will be. But like I said, I think there will be a lot of weighing next year on the 1-year deal versus multi-year deal. And I think you take a multi-year deal depending on your age and of course how much they're going to offer you. Because teams are not going to look, the league is probably going to look to bring this in as easy as possible. And they're not going to look to fundamentally change contracts. They're not going to look to accelerate market growth everywhere. A lot of times what you see with some of these things is that you'll see some of the lower deals actually rise, you know, so I'm not exactly sure, but yeah, I do think next year you're going to see a lot more 1-year contracts. Tim says, when Drew Lock becomes top 10 to 15 quarterback these next 2 years, what will his contract look like? So if he puts himself into that discussion to where he's an entrenched starter, you know, you don't know where the cap is going to be, but based on where the numbers are now, I would say when you talk about an entrenched starter and you're talking about someone who's competent, you know, and has organizational faith in them, you're probably looking at $34 million a season. And last question. Marco says, what are Watson's fines and or de-escalators in his contract? And when does he have to repay unearned signing bonus? Are all the fines mandatory? So the fines are all mandatory. The de-escalators are for missing workouts. I think that's $500,000. That automatically just takes his paragraph 5 salary down, I would guess, unless it's excused. Same thing with fines. Unless the fines are excused, they're mandatory as well. So he's looking at a lot of fines. You know, it's $50,000 a day, I think, in training camp. I mean, there's some small fines right now. That's kind of like unimportant. But the training camp fines, I think, are $50,000 a day where you miss out. The repayment of signing bonus money, forfeiture kicks in when you miss 5 days. And then it accrues like every day up to your first 25%, you know, of your prorations for the year. And then when you miss week one, it's another 25%. I think they can ask you for those whenever. That's not mandatory. But, you know, eventually those forfeiture clauses will kick in and then you get the money when you get the money. If you're the team, you'll get it back eventually. But yeah, that's generally how that works. But the fines are mandatory. I have no idea how that's going to work out. That is just a very, very, very ridiculous situation going on right now in Houston. I think that's it, though. I think that's it for the questions for tonight. So that was actually a lot of questions. I'm surprised I got that many. Hopefully that gave you at least some insight onto some of those topics. And hopefully I'll be back next week. So if you have any other questions, you can send them over. Or if you have any topics that you think will be interesting, you can let me know, and hopefully I'll be back next week to talk with everyone. In the meantime, Nelly, say goodbye. All right. Yep, there we go, Nelly. It's been relatively quiet for the most part. So everyone have a great week, and I will talk to you all again soon.